The terror inspired by the first wave of the HIV/AIDS epidemic led to some major gains in the effort to understand and treat HIV. Those gains obviously could not come fast enough for millions of people who died of the disease. A death sentence is what an HIV diagnosis amounted to in the 1980s. That's obviously changed over time because of some major breakthroughs, including the cases of the so-called Berlin patients. Their story is told in the book Cured, How the Berlin Patients Defeated HIV and Forever Changed Medical Science. Nathalia Holt is the author. She is herself a research scientist who specializes in HIV biology, with key developments to her credit in the HIV gene therapy field and awards to show for those. Nathalia Holt, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. We had a recent interview about Dr. Robert Koch and his search for a cure for tuberculosis in the 1870s and 1880s. It seems like HIV has a lot of comparisons in the way that medical science really fixated and focused on it.
Yes, you can draw comparisons with tuberculosis and also cancer as well. There's some interesting parallels there. And these are all diseases that at the time were very little understood, and so much research and so much interest has gone into pursuing them and trying to find therapies that will work for them.
You mentioned, too, in the book, Koch's postulates. Dr. Koch himself, the approach that he took to disease is still used to this day. What are some of the major features of Koch's postulates?
So it's a way of looking at how to define disease, and it's something that actually doesn't tend to work very well in modern times for many diseases, but it's a way of being able to define what causes a disease and really being able to look at what the root causes are.
The people that you profiled in this book, Cured, obviously were cured, but why is the term cure used so cautiously? You go on for a while about this in the book.
It's a term that for a long time no one in HIV would use. Nobody wanted to talk about cure because there had been so many hopeful promises so many times that it looked as if we were close to being able to understand HIV and understanding how to stop it. And we've had so many disappointments. And many of these disappointments have been in vaccine trials. And so for this reason, you would never go to a conference and be able to hear the word cure. It was just something that people felt like was so far away from anything that we were close to researching. And that has really changed now. It's such a radical change that's happened in HIV medicine. It's happened so quickly that we've gone from not being able to use the word to having the word prominent in conferences, to being able to talk about patients that are cured and to openly talk about them this way, and to have symposiums and all kinds of research now that we're openly pursuing a cure. It's kind of an amazing turnaround from where we were even 5 years ago.
But it is still its pursuit of a cure then. I mean, the fact is that there are some people and some individuals that have been cured, but the approach that works for them, does it not work for the other people?
Yes. So we have a few people that have been cured of HIV, but their experiences and the therapy they've received are not ones that we can repeat in other people. And because of this, we're really actively pursuing other ways to learn from their experience and really try to learn what's at the root of their therapy. And then we've now developed clinical trials using what we've learned from these patients to be able to apply it to a large number of people.
You point out a difference between a functional cure and a sterilizing cure. What is that difference?
This is such a big area for medicine because we really thought for a long time that to be able to cure HIV, we had to be able to get rid of every last bit of virus in a person. And this is something that is almost impossible to do because the virus is able to hide out in just every part of your body that you can imagine. It can hide in your gut. It can hide in your bone marrow. It can hide in your brain. And so to be able to get rid of all of it, to have a sterilizing cure, is a very high bar. And so what we're doing now is we're looking for functional cures. And the idea here is that there'll always be a trace of the virus that's left behind, some small amount of virus that the body can control. And this is a much more achievable kind of cure, and we know it is because we now have multiple people, the Berlin patients, as well as a few others, who have experienced this kind of cure. So this is such a radical idea for medicine, this idea that we don't need to wipe out the virus. We just need to get it to a point where the body can control it.
All right, so that's an important point to bring out. With the Berlin patients and the others, the virus does still exist at some level in their bodies?
Yes, it does. There are levels that they're so tiny that we can only detect them through the most sensitive tests. So they're not levels that really you would really be able to detect through like a normal doctor appointment, but we've actually had to design these incredibly sophisticated tests just to be able to find virus in these small number of people.
And the sorts of things that happen with the Berlin patients, not easily replicated then in other people?
Yes, it's the nature of their therapies. So one patient had a very aggressive early therapy using a cancer drug, and that's something that you wouldn't want to be able to give to everyone because it's a toxic drug and it could cause side effects. And the second Berlin patient received a stem cell transplant, which is also just a very dangerous procedure that you wouldn't want to give to everyone.
Nathalia Holt, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Cured. It's about the Berlin patients and how they defeated HIV, and their doctors obviously helped them with that, too. We'll talk about the medical science that led to the cure of the Berlin patients and what has happened to lots of other cases since then, and return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails as well. Back with Nathalia Holt and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Nathalia Holt, a medical researcher and author. Her book is Cured, How the Berlin Patients Defeated HIV and Forever Changed Medical Science. It's an interesting discovery of process that worked for some people, but not for everybody, which is still where we are with HIV, although we have made great gains over the years. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this process and HIV treatment more generally. 800-838-3760. Anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Nathalia, there's an exciting start to the book. I mean, what happened to you in the lab at Children's Hospital in L.A.?
Yes, so this is a story that is actually kind of an embarrassing story for me, but I felt like it was important to start the book with it because in a book where I reveal so much of the personal lives and the personal stories of these men and their doctors, I kind of wanted to give a little peek into an embarrassing time of my own. So I was a graduate student working at University of Southern California on my dissertation, and I was doing a project, a gene therapy project in mice. And as part of that project, I was injecting humanized mice with a very aggressive lab-adapted version of HIV. And just as I was about to plunge the needle of this highly aggressive, highly concentrated HIV in a mouse, I ended up poking myself in the finger with the virus. And the story is important because I didn't get HIV. I was very lucky. I was able to get therapy, and I was able to not get the virus at all. But it was a moment for me that made HIV more than just a virus that I was studying and made me think more about the human aspect of the disease. Because it was a time that, you know, I suddenly had to take these drugs that made me so sick, and you know, I was taking them through my own foolishness. I had to take these drugs for a month, but I couldn't help but think of the millions of people that have to take these drugs every day for the rest of their lives. And, of course, the many people who don't even have access to these drugs. It's only about a third of people with HIV that do have access to medication. So it was a really important moment for me because it really made me think of the virus as more than a disease and really made me think about the people behind it. And that's something that I felt like was very important for this book. I really wanted to bring that human aspect and talk about the personal stories of these physicians and these patients and what they went through and how it's affecting the lives of millions of people today.
You were pretty hard on yourself, though, I have to say. I mean, you described this as a moment of weakness when I needed strength. How do you figure?
Well, it was just a foolish accident, and it's the kind of accident that happens to physicians and researchers all over the country every day. People do things like this and have needle sticks. But it was a really it's an embarrassing thing to do, to stick yourself, of course. It's not a great moment in science for me. But luckily, when I look back at it, it's something that I've been very fortunate that I didn't have any lasting effects from and that I didn't get HIV.
That really is lucky because, as you pointed out, this is a particularly virulent strain. I mean, this was like full power HIV you were injecting the mice with.
Yes, I was very lucky to be able to get on the therapy right away and be able to block the virus from entering my cells.
Something you said about the mice that you were doing this experiment with, the humanized mice, what does that mean?
This is such an incredible thing that we have in medicine today. And it's the ability to take a mouse and reconstitute human tissue within it. So what we have are, we have mice that have immune deficiencies. So basically they have kind of the boy in the bubble syndrome. They can't make an immune system of their own. So when these mice are injected with stem cells or with other mature blood cells, they can create a functional human immune system. And of course, it's not perfect. It'll never be exactly like a human immune system. But it's an incredible resource for researchers because it allows us to look at human disease and human drugs in a mouse. And this is really wonderful because it means that we can use less primate models, and it means that we can do things much more efficiently. And I guess I should say that I have many reservations about using animals in research. I think it's something that no one likes to do, but there's definitely research that really can benefit from animal models, and HIV is one of those that I feel very lucky we have this resource. And as long as we're picking our research carefully and really very thoughtfully about what we're doing with these animals and making sure that they do not suffer and are treated very well, this is just an incredible resource to medicine, and it's something that's been very important for HIV because it's allowed us to go to the next step, to human clinical trials, without having to go through monkey models first. So it's really been able to rapidly accelerate science.
Well, it's not great for the mice, but great for the people who depend upon what we learn from them. Let us talk about viruses generally, though, because I don't know how many people understand the difference between viruses and bacteria, for example. So when viruses get in the body, do they tend to do the same sorts of things?
You know, viruses are interesting because there's such a variety of them. So HIV is a special kind of virus. It's called a retrovirus. And what's interesting about HIV is that it's able to directly inject itself into our own DNA. And this is really something special that only a few kind of viruses can do. But it's able to use our cell's machinery against us. So it goes into a cell, it sneaks itself into our DNA, and then it uses our cell to make all of its own proteins. So this is very sneaky, and it's one of the reasons why it's been so difficult to treat HIV. It's because it's able to hide within our own genetic code. You can imagine how difficult it is to be able to get rid of a virus that's just hiding within our DNA.
And that's so it really essentially uses our system to make more of itself.
Yes, that's exactly what it's doing. Yeah, it just takes over our cells and churns out as much virus as it possibly can.
And I remember reading not terribly long ago that the human genome is really just littered with defunct virus parts. Is that a fair assessment?
It is. It's kind of an archaeological find that we can sort of go back in time and look at all of these old viruses that were able to insert itself in our DNA.
All right, let's talk about some of the key human players in the book, though. Dr. Heiko Jessen in Berlin, a biography of him would be very welcome if somebody hasn't written one already. What was his path into medicine?
So he is, you know, from a small town in Germany, and he wanted to be a doctor, but he never thought that he would be treating HIV. And so he decided he wanted to be a family doctor. And it's really kind of a wonderful thing in Germany that you have so many family doctors, but many of them have these very close relationships with his patients. So Heiko went from thinking he would never treat a patient with HIV to opening a clinic that mostly serves the needs of young gay men and treats a lot of HIV. And so he's a really wonderful family physician who really takes a lot of time with his patients, who really cares about the men that he treats and really is is always looking for ways to further their health and really looks out for their best interests.
Was it some personal experience that brought him back into treating people with HIV?
Yes. He went through a very difficult time during his training. He went to San Francisco at the height of the AIDS epidemic, and he is a gay physician himself, but he had never seen gay culture impacted the way he did in San Francisco. And it was one of these kind of turning points that you have in your life where you see all of this destruction around you and you think, oh, there's nothing I can do. There's really no way that I can possibly fix this. But then when he returned to Germany, he really just kind of underwent this revolution where he decided that he really wanted to be part of the solution and really wanted to find a way to end HIV, which is kind of an amazing thing coming from a family doctor. And that's one thing I like about both of the physicians I profiled is that they're not people that you would expect a cure for HIV to come from. They're both physicians that don't come from big, high-powered research labs or have an enormous amount of resources. They're both actually quite young researchers, but they both had these just very clever ideas, and because of their close relationships with their patients, they were able to bring them to fruition.
We're talking to Nathalia Holt on the Jefferson Exchange. She is a medical researcher or a research scientist herself, and she's the author of the book Cured, How the Berlin Patients Defeated HIV and Forever Changed Medical Science. We're talking about one of the doctors just now, Dr. Heiko Jessen. You can join this discussion about how science approached treatment of HIV over the years and what the breakthroughs were. 800-838-3760 across the listening area. Across the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. I haven't even tried to pronounce the name of the other doctor. We talked about Heiko Jessen. Was it Dagiro Hütter?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So what was his story? What got him into his line of work?
So Giro was an oncologist. He still is an oncologist. And he had never treated an HIV patient in his life. And then he met Timothy. So this is his first patient with HIV. And as soon as he met Timothy, he just had this really crazy idea. He wanted to be able to treat both the cancer that Timothy had just been diagnosed with and his HIV, which he had been living with for a decade. And he got this idea just from a paper that he had been reading in his med school library. You know, so a decade earlier, he had read a paper about a small group of people who, because they have a mutation, they're able to keep HIV out of all the cells of their body, and they're resistant to the virus. And so Giro had this idea when he met Timothy, well, what if I can give Timothy both of these cells that have this mutation so they could protect him from the virus, and these cells would also be able to defeat his cancer? And pretty much when he said this idea, no one in his hospital believed it would work. Everyone just thought, this is crazy. No one's done anything like this. There's just no way that something like this will work. But it did work, and Timothy has now been off therapy for 7 years. It's almost impossible to find any virus in Timothy at this point. So Giro really has done something quite incredible, and his work has just spurned this amazing clinical trials that are looking at gene therapy to treat HIV.
Timothy Ray Brown and Christian Hahn are the names we use of the two Berlin patients. Are those both pseudonyms?
Timothy Ray Brown is his real name, mm-hmm. and Christian is a pseudonym. He decided that he would prefer to remain anonymous. He really loves his privacy.
Mm-hmm. And so what was Christian's story? Very different, apparently, from Timothy's.
Very different. So Christian was diagnosed very early in HIV infection. He'd only been infected for a few days when he went to his doctor in Germany, his family doctor, Heiko. And Heiko decided to put him on this very radical treatment that he had given very few people with HIV. But because Christian was so early in infection and because he felt like he could responsibly take these drugs, he decided to try it. And so Christian was put on a very early aggressive therapy that was able to clear out the virus before it got a foothold in his body. And what's very special about his story is that it's now being done, the same strategy is now being done in some children with HIV. So we have a few children now who have the virus has similarly been cleared of their bodies after given early therapy. And there's also been a group of men in France who have similarly been given early therapy. So this idea of early aggressive therapy is starting to get more and more attention, and it really did start with this one early case.
Well, but the drug still available at the time, I think, was AZT. Is that true? That was the one that was generally the go-to for HIV in those days still?
Yes, at that time, it was just turning over. We had just started to have our first combination drugs for HIV. And this was such an exciting time. So this is 1996 when things started to change. And it's with the advent of combination drugs that we're able to give people these long lifespans that they have now with HIV.
And so, I mean, if you have the medication, can AIDS, as far as anybody knows, be forestalled forever? I mean, will HIV not develop into AIDS?
Yes, we have people that have been on these therapies for decades now and have not progressed to AIDS, and this is such a wonderful thing. It doesn't work for everyone. There are people that have trouble with the drugs, who the drugs just simply can't control their virus. And, of course, there are many people who don't have access to the drugs at all. But it's such an amazing thing now that we have such a huge number of drugs that are able to keep HIV in check.
I want to ask a little question here, sort of on the side, out of the scope of what's been in the book. I mean, there are those people who claim, I don't know why, that HIV and AIDS are not connected. Have you delved much into that line of thought and why it exists?
I think that there are always going to be people with conspiracy theories. And unfortunately, what's happened with the people you're talking about, AIDS denialists, is that it's had a very detrimental effect, particularly in places like South Africa, where the former president was an AIDS denialist and kept drugs from that country for quite a long time. And because of that, we just see so many cases of HIV there and such a high prevalence, particularly in young women. So in some places in rural South Africa, we actually have HIV prevalence rates that are about 80% in young women, and it's just such a travesty that this has happened. And it's unfortunate that these AIDS denialists have had such an effect on so many people.
Has it had much of an influence on the research, or has the research been able to sort of push that off to the side and continue to do what it's been doing?
I think for researchers, it's such a dedicated group of people that are working on this disease. It's not something that has negatively impacted research. But I think, you know, for many people in medicine, it's always disheartening when you have a group of people who kind of doggedly pursue these kind of beliefs.
Nathalia Holt, I must say that as I read through the book, you are able to go micro and macro pretty well. So, I mean, we're able to see the societal implications of the research, but also right down to the cellular level, what's going on with the specifics of what does and does not work with HIV. And I want to get into now, what are T cells and why do you call them stormtroopers?
Yes, so I use kind of this military analogy for the immune system. And T cells are such an important part of that. So I call them stormtroopers. We have different kinds of T cells. So we have T cells that are the generals. These are CD4 T cells. And these are the ones that coordinate the attack and figure out different methods of attack on viruses and other intruders. And then we have the stormtroopers, which are exactly how they sound like. They're the ones that are going out there and clearing out the virus. And it's very important that we have both of them make up such an important part of our immune system. And we're now looking at ways that we can really initiate stormtrooper attacks and be able to use that part of the immune system to wipe out HIV.
So I'm curious, when the body deals with viruses, does it actually destroy individual virus cells or does it render them inert?
It does both. So we have different ways of dealing with viruses. We have ways of using antibodies that can kind of ensnare the virus and then be able to take it to be disposed of. And then we have these other kinds of cells that are able to directly kill the virus. So So we have, that's an amazing thing about our immune system, is that we have so many different ways to kill off intruders. But what HIV does that is particularly devious is that it goes after the generals of the immune system. And by doing this, it just creates an enormous amount of destruction.
Right. It wipes out the command structure, in a sense, for how the body will deal with the disease. We're talking to Nathalia Holt about her book, Cured, How the Berlin Patients Defeated HIV and Forever Changed Medical Science. We'll come back and talk more with Nathalia and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the scientist, the medical researcher, Nathalia Holt. She has written a book about some other research and its successes. The book is called Cured, How the Berlin Patients Defeated HIV and Forever Changed Medical Science. It's a discussion of two men in Berlin who we know today as Christian Hahn and Timothy Ray Brown. Timothy Ray Brown is his real name, Christian Hahn, not his real name, and about the doctors and the research that it took to get to the point of getting these men essentially HIV-free. You can join the discussion about HIV and viruses generally and the approaches to treatment discussed in the world at large and in this book, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@defnet.org. When we go back in time, you're pretty good about showing us what the level of knowledge was in the early days of AIDS and HIV. It wasn't even called AIDS back then. I mean, it was GRID at some point, gay-related immune deficiency. When you look back at that history, Nathalia, does it seem sort of like the Dark Ages to you?
It really does. It's hard to imagine that there was so much discrimination then. It's when you look at how schools excluded children that had HIV, when you look at firefighters and police officers and doctors that wouldn't treat patients with HIV, it's just hard to imagine what life really was like when you had HIV at that time, and incredible how much has changed since then.
You describe a truly depressing AIDS conference in 1993 where it looked like everything was hopeless. How quickly did things turn around? For example, how different was the next year's conference?
Things still weren't so good by the next year. Unfortunately, so much of our history in HIV is about many trials that have gone wrong and many vaccines that haven't worked. And it was really not until we had the first combination therapy, and that was in 1996, that things started to look better. But there was still this feeling that we need a vaccine, we need a cure for HIV. And it's really only in just the last 5 years that the field feels like this is something that is really going to happen and that we're very close to being able to deliver on that promise now.
I want to ask just about virus behavior generally again. I mean, the way that HIV can respond so differently to treatment from person to person, I mean, is that a feature of HIV specifically, or is that something that happens with viruses more generally?
It's something special about HIV. HIV is able to mutate rapidly. So it's able to get around the drugs that we have very quickly. And that's one of the reasons why AZT was such a problem, is because the drug was able to get around it. And then when we had combination drugs, it was finally a way for us to be able to attack different parts of the virus and therefore be able to control it. But even then, even with those drugs, we are still continually having to come up with new drugs because the virus is just able to outthink us and get around all our drugs. So it's a fight that never ends. We're constantly having to try to stay one step ahead of the virus.
AZT and some of these other treatments, these are antiviral drugs, aren't they?
AZT actually started out as a cancer drug, mm-hmm. Not as a drug that was actually used in any people, but it was developed as a cancer drug. And in the 1960s, by Jerome Horwitz, and then it just sort of sat for decades without a thought before it was picked up again in the 80s as an HIV drug. And it was really one of many compounds that were tried against HIV. And what's interesting about the drug is that it doesn't attack the virus. It actually attacks the cell. So because the virus needs our cells, it needs to be able to use our cells' machinery to make more of itself. the idea of attacking the cell instead of the virus was quite a radical idea at the time. And even though AZT did not work for many people and unfortunately could not keep people alive for very long, it was sort of our first start at having a drug that was able to work against HIV. And it was a drug that really did inspire researchers to think about other ways to attack the virus and other ways to close off the cell to the virus as well.
I can see why people got some bad effects from AZT. Then essentially what you're doing is you're disrupting the cell to make life unpleasant for the virus, but you're certainly going to make life unpleasant for the cell's owners as well.
That is very true. Yes, and it is chemotherapy, and it is something that has very toxic side effects.
I want to talk about, coming back to the Berlin patient specifically, Christian Hahn, as we know him, took a really interesting turn in his treatment. Why did Christian decide to stop taking pills?
Yes, so he went against his doctor's advice, and he had only been on therapy for about 6 months when he decided to stop taking the pills. And his experience is so interesting because he felt that the virus was gone from his system. So every day that he took the pills, he did this visualization. And this visualization is kind of funny because it was actually based on a toilet bowl cleaner commercial from the 70s where he remembered a toilet bowl was getting magically clean. And he thought about this every time he took the drugs, and he imagined them cleaning his body in a similar way. And he had one of these just eureka moments when he was by himself in a window in his dorm room looking out at the snow, where he just felt like the virus was gone from his body and he just felt completely healthy. And he decided that he wasn't going to take the drugs anymore. And his physician, you know, tried to dissuade him from this idea, but it was such a powerful idea for him that he stopped taking the drugs, and it turned out that he was right. The virus didn't come back.
Interesting. So he just thought he was healthy, and he really was.
Yes. I mean, it's hard to say if there's any validity towards visualizations or that kind of feeling, that how making your body feel healthy, it's hard to say. But for him, he still believes that it was his visualizations and his thinking about his body that turned it around for him. So it was certainly a powerful moment for him. Whether medically it's true or not, it's hard to say, isn't it?
It really is. Now, one of the things you point out, though, is that the Christian did keep his appointment, so he wasn't taking any drugs anymore, but he was showing up for his appointment so they could do the lab work. And over what period of time did the lab work show a reduction in HIV in his system?
Yes, right away they had trouble finding the virus. As soon as he stopped taking the drugs and was going back, they were sure that the virus would return, because that is what typically happens. Typically after you go off therapy, the virus will return. And that didn't happen for him. And they did an incredible amount of tests to be able to find the virus. They were able to find a small amount of virus in his body, and this virus should have been able to repopulate his whole system, but it turns out that it was a small enough amount of virus that his body was able to control it. And so this is really an important idea when we're talking about functional cures, this idea that there is an amount of virus that you're able to control in your body.
So did he inadvertently stumble upon something that actually works for other HIV patients as well?
So this idea of using early aggressive therapy has been used and has been effective in some people. It's a matter of being able to test it in a wide enough group is something that's happening now. Now we're looking more at early aggressive therapy. And many people, including Anthony Fauci, who's the director of the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, believes that children will actually be the first group that benefit from this idea, that they'll be the first group of people that are actually cured of HIV, because this idea of early aggressive therapy seems to work well in infants. This is something that we only have data from a very few patients, so it's still early, but it's something that many people in the field are very excited about.
Nathalia, we have a question from one of our listeners here. Jeannie in Medford wants to know, is HIV a treatment used for other things like multiple sclerosis? And I guess if anybody's been watching medical shows on TV, there was a recent set of episodes of Grey's Anatomy where HIV was used to treat something else. Does that really happen in the real world?
It does happen. So it's not a form of HIV like we think of it. It's not this very deadly virus, but it's a form of HIV where all of basically the guts have been taken out, and instead you just have the shell of the virus. And this is because HIV is so good at getting into our cells and getting into our DNA that it has actually been used as this sort of shell that can carry in many other genes. So it's been used for other kinds of gene therapy. It's also been used for cancer treatments. There's a really dramatic story of a young girl named Emily Whitehead who was given this therapy, given this sort of shell of HIV, that was able to stimulate her T cells and clear her cancer, which really everybody thought was not treatable. So it is very exciting what the virus is capable of doing when we take away the dangerous parts of it.
So what is the general trajectory in this day and age, then, for somebody who has access to treatment? As you pointed out, only a third of the people in the world who have HIV get access to the medications that help. So what's the general pathway, then? I mean, how long? I mean, early aggressive treatment for sure, but, I mean, basically upon diagnosis, yes, you have HIV, boom, here are your drugs. Which drugs are in use now, and how long can people expect to carry HIV with no further complications?
So besides this early aggressive therapy, which of course will only work when you're first diagnosed, the other part of a cure, which is based on Timothy Ray Brown, is this idea of using gene therapy. So to make someone's body look like a person who is naturally resistant to HIV. And these are now in clinical trials, so we can expect that it'll be about 10 to 15 years before it's able to go to the general population. But the early results from these clinical trials have been very promising. And so this is very exciting, this idea that we might be able to actually change a person's immune system so that they can clear the virus on their own.
You mentioned earlier that the two major doctors who were treating the Berlin patients, Heiko Jessen and Gero Hütter, they were not really researchers. They were clinicians. They did their work on patients day to day. They saw patients day to day. In your opinion, Nathalia, did that actually help them in the sense that they're willing to throw a bunch of things up against the wall and just see what stuck?
It really helped them because they were able to look at the specific patient they had and really try to figure out what was the best therapy for them. So there is such an important role that clinical trials play and such an important role that research plays in medicine, but I think we sometimes forget the role that individual doctors and family physicians and primary care doctors can have on patients just because of their relationships, just because of their ability to really assess what a patient needs. And in both of these cases, these are physicians that tailored a treatment specific to their patients, and they had these dramatic effects that are now just changing the field completely.
And you had a chance to meet the doctors that you wrote about here?
Yes, I was able to spend time with them, and it was wonderful to really learn their stories and just really to get to know them personally. And I tried to bring as much of that as I could in the book, because I think it's wonderful to get to see that human side of physicians as well as the science that they do.
You had some issues, I understand, with some of the players in the game. Apparently, talking to you did talk to Timothy Brown and Christian Hahn as well. Had some issues, I guess, with one of Timothy's friends.
I did have some issues with one of Timothy's friends, and unfortunately, he just kind of had some personal problems that he made life difficult for Timothy as well. These things happen, I think, you know, when you get to know people and you get to know their friends and family, it's just kind of what happens. There's always going to be some tensions that arise. But overall, just such a great experience to really get to talk to them and get to learn as much of their personal stories as I could.
It is really interesting, too, to think about the fact that it does take lots of different people with lots of different experiences to get to where we are today with treatment for HIV, because in addition to the patients, you have the two German doctors who are working with these patients, but you need the people who are seeing the patients on a daily basis and the people like you who are working with mice in a laboratory to get this all to come together.
Yeah, exactly. Everyone is an important player in this, and I think it's good that we remember that it's about all of the ways that we think about research happening in big labs and happening in big research institutes, but also even just at the level of primary care physicians that are meeting with their patients, too. So it's good to see it all on the same spectrum and how it's all contributing to medicine today.
While your book focuses on the two men in Berlin, I mean, is there still just a limited number, like maybe a couple of dozen people who can be reported as cured of HIV in the world?
That's right. So we have these two men. We have a child that was born in Mississippi who is now 3 years old, who has also been called functionally cured of HIV. There's a second child who is still an infant and still on therapy, so she's not cured yet. But we have some indications that the virus has been cleared from her body. And then we have another group of men in France who were given an early aggressive therapy and have similarly been cleared of the virus. So the list is growing, and it's something that we just hope that will continue to grow, and especially as these clinical trials really come to fruition, that's really our way to be able to get as many people cleared of the virus as possible.
There's just a whole lot to take in the book. It's called Cured, How the Berlin Patients Defeated HIV and Forever Changed Medical Science. Nathalia Holt wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Thank you so much, Nathalia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you. That'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. You can find out more about the program and subjects and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. Find us as well on Facebook or on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. Tomorrow, Thursday on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about preparations for fire season right down the road. At 8:30, we'll talk about exploring psychedelics, use and misuse. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to the attendees in an Oregon-China conference about increasing business connections between the two entities. That's all tomorrow on the Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran. Our student assistant is Megan Mercier. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.